the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, if you're one of those individuals that have been successful and moved up the corporate ladder, you probably notice that your compensation changes dramatically. Everything from stock options to deferred comp to special retirement packages. Today, our subject on the show is tax planning for corporate executives. Joining me on the program is certified financial planner and private wealth manager, Paul Horn from PFS Group. Paul, let's talk about what exactly is executive compensation and who is it offered to? In other words, at which level do you have to rise to at a corporation before you have that option available to you?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question, Jim. Really, for executive comp, people think that you have to be C-level suite to really qualify for this, and that's really not the case. We have a ton of clients that are middle managers in large corporations, engineers, or other special talents that companies want to retain. And so if you qualify either as some sort of management, or more often what I've seen is some sort of engineer or someone with special technical abilities that companies want to keep, they will offer these sort of benefits to them as a way to help increase employee retention.
I know that there's things like stock options. You can read in the Wall Street Journal about some top-level executive where his salary is such a small fraction of his overall compensation because it comes from stock options. So what kind of options are available or what kind of things are out there in terms of executive comp?
Executive comp comes in several forms. It can be a very basic thing like cash or some sort of executive perk where they get special deals on joining health clubs or use of a private jet or something like that. But those are typically far and few between. Typically, the most common ones we see are different sort of options that are tied to performance. The idea being here that obviously employees in these roles do very well at their jobs, and so being performance-based seems to be in everyone's best interest. Those could come in the form of one of three things. That's either stock options, some form of deferred comp plan, or another type of plan which is called long-term incentive plans. And those are really gaining popularity nowadays with the fact that they are tied to performance.
What are these long-term incentive plans? Are they stock options? Are they deferred compensation? Or are they special retirement packages?
They work more as a contract. A good example is we have a client working for a real estate company that has one of these where he's going to be receiving executive pay, but it's going to be tied to the performance of the company on the project that he's working on. And it's a contract that will grant him stock in the company, but how much stock he receives is going to be based on both his performance and the company's performance over a 3-year window.
So I know, Paul, that when these plans are offered to individuals, and of course, every company has a different version of it, and surprisingly, some companies have different forms of stock options. How do you help clients determine executive comp plans, which ones are best suited to a client's personal needs?
With each client, there are two things that we really focus on. First thing we're going to look at is going to be tax planning, looking at the tax implication of the stock options and where they currently are. You know, are they subject to AMT or not? Things like that that we need to determine. Secondly, it's going to be what is their objective or what is their goal? Typically, clients with stock options will fall into one of three different objectives. One is diversification. The most common ones, though, tend to be either minimizing taxes or trying to accumulate more wealth, trying to grow their wealth. The one thing that we do see with these options is over time, it does lead to a concentrated stock position in the company if there isn't careful planning.
Yeah, and some of the risk of that is I know that there was a very famous case at the beginning of the last decade with the company called Enron, where a lot of the executives, a lot of the employees had a lot of their compensation in stock in the company, both in the retirement plan and also corporate executives with options. And of course, we know what happened with that. Now, when you talk about stock options being the most popular type, what are the different types of stock options? Because I know there's like 3 or 4 variations of different stock options.
Correct. Yeah. Stock options come in 3 flavors. The one that is least common but has the largest benefit are what are called incentive stock options. They're more commonly referred to as ISOs. The second one that we see more commonly are non-qualified stock options. Those are NSOs. And then the one that has gained the most popularity in recent years, and the one that I see most commonly for clients, are what are called RSUs, which are restricted stock units. The reason that we're seeing the RSUs more common is they favor the company from a tax perspective, and the company doesn't have to have the stock on their books when they issue the RSUs, or if they do the ISOs or NSOs, the company actually has to have those stocks set aside on their books for those plans.
One of the things that we know, and this would probably explain the RSUs, is when a company reports earnings, they have to report earnings based on a regular basis and a fully diluted basis. And the fully diluted basis is all stock options that the company has on the books that could be potentially issued, which obviously lowers the per share earnings. Can you address, if you would, the various tax differences between those three plans?
That's an excellent question. Yeah, and to talk about the different tax implications, it's first important to understand how these stock options work. There's really three separate dates that a person needs to be aware of. The first one is the option grant date. That's the date that the stock option is given to them. That really starts the time clock for each option. The second date that we pay attention to is what is called the exercise date, and that's the date that the person chooses to exercise their option, and this will apply to both ISOs, incentive stock options, and NSOs, the non-qualified stock options. And then the last date that we look at is the date of sell, and that's when they decide to sell the stock options and receive the cash. Now, with a ISO, incentive stock options, what happens is at the date of grant, they need to hold the stock for at least 1 year before they exercise it, and then they need to wait another year, so a total of 2 years from the date of exercise to the date of sell, in order to get the tax advantage treatment that the ISO offers. And what happens with the ISO is it allows the appreciation in the stock to be treated as long-term capital gains. So as an example, let's say the stock is trading at $10 per share on the date of grant. Then let's say they exercise it a year later and the stock is worth $15. And then let's say they wait another year to sell. So we're talking 2 years from the date of grant. And let's say at that point the stock is worth $25 per share. So then that $15 in gain, the 25 minus the $10, right? All that $15 in gain per share is treated as long-term capital gains, which is going to be more favorable to the client. Now, the challenge with these ISOs is if you're subject to AMT taxes, that what's called bargain element, which is the date of exercise, in this example, again, was $15 versus the $10 on the date of grant. So that $5 per share is an AMT preference item, and that could increase your AMT taxes. So that is something to be aware of if you're subject to AMT. On the NSOs, they work similar, however, a little bit different with that bargain element. So again, using that same example of $10 date of grant, $15 date of exercise, $25 date of sale. That $15, which is the difference of date of exercise minus the date of grant, that $5 per share is treated as ordinary income. And then if they hold the shares for at least 1 year, then that $10 again in that same example would then be treated as long-term capital gains. If they exercise and then sell the shares under 12 months, it's treated as short-term capital gains.
So it seems to me that between either ISOs or NSOs, the ISO favors the employee the most because being taxed at long-term capital gains, putting aside the AMT possibility, there's a lower tax there. What about RSUs? How are they treated differently? You mentioned earlier it favors the company because the company doesn't have to put the stock options on the books until probably, when they're exercised?
Yeah, so with the RSUs, there actually is no exercise date. What happens is the RSU is given on the date of grant, and then there's going to be a quote-unquote exercise date, which is really a sell date. That could be a year or 2 years later. And at that point, whatever gain is in that stock, so let's say it starts at 10, ends at 25, that full amount is treated as ordinary income. So that would be $15 per share in that same example. That would be ordinary income at the time that the RSUs are what is called vested. So whatever that vest date is, let's say it's $25 per share. Again, that's $15 per share. That's ordinary income. Now, if they choose to hold it after that date, then any gain after the vesting date then will be subject to long-term or short-term capital gains, depending if they hold it 12 months or less. Oftentimes with RSUs, I like to treat those as a cash bonus. So when it's vested, have them just sell it, take the cash, and then diversify because they've already paid the taxes on that money.
So if I look at all three of these type of stock options, obviously ISOs are the most favorable to the employee because any gain on the stock is treated as long-term capital gains. NSOs, a little bit less favorable, but still long-term capital gains, where RSUs are really just, as you mentioned, any difference or gain in the stock is treated as ordinary income, which is almost like getting a cash bonus. What do you find most companies use? It seems like if I wanted to retain an employee, I would want to help them out from a tax point of view, especially if it's a highly compensated executive or an engineer or somebody that has special talents that I want to retain as an employee.
What I see from most higher level executives is a combination of these. And oftentimes they won't have just stock options. It will be tied as well to a deferred compensation plan, or it could also include something like we talked earlier with the long-term incentive plan. They'll typically have a combination of stock options and a combination of some other type of plan as well. Now, within the stock options, the IRS recognizes the benefits of the ISOs, so they're actually limited to $100,000 per year at most that any person can receive in the ISOs to get the tax preferential treatment.
So let's say I am a super executive and you see these packages where, you know, somebody will get several million shares and stock options. Obviously, that's probably not going to be an ISO because those are limited to 100,000. Are there any limitations to the NSOs?
There's not limitations like that with the NSOs, but if you're an insider or a like position, there could be restrictions on the ability to sell your stock. And when you get into that level, if you're an insider or a like person, there are some additional restrictions that we can find on these stock sales. And if that's the case, then we want to get into some other type of planning around things like 10B5-1 plans. That's another option that we can look at when you're in that insider level.
What do you recommend a client do when it comes to selling stock options? Obviously, we've been in a bull market for the last 8 or 9 years. I can imagine that over the last 8 or 9 years, some of those options that have been granted to executives are worth a lot of money at this point. And we know what happens to the value of stock in bear markets, where, for example, in the downturn between 2007 and 2009, the market lost 58% of its value. So what do you do in terms of recommending to a client in terms of selling? Because a lot of times, let's say an executive is with the company, each year he starts accumulating a number of stock options. So they're tiered at different prices based on the number of years of service. What do you recommend?
With the stock option planning, it is really a case-by-case situation. We work very closely with the client's CPAs to determine the tax implications. And really, it comes down to what strategy we use in terms of the timing of the exercise or the timing of the sell. It's really going to be based on what their objective is. So if they're trying to maximize their wealth accumulation, maybe we have them exercise and hold it to get the long-term capital gains if we're bullish on the company they're working for. Other times, it may be prudent to sell, or similar to dollar cost averaging, where you're consistently buying into a mutual fund. Another strategy that can become common is to do the same thing on selling, because no one has a crystal ball to perfectly time the market, but doing a sort of approach where we're systematically selling either a number of shares or selling a dollar amount over a period of time is another way to kind of dollar cost or help handle the market fluctuations.
Can you give us a couple examples of, let's say, some actual case studies where you've taken executives either with ISOs, NSOs, or RSUs, or various types of compensation, and the strategies that you've used to help that individual?
Absolutely. So we do have a client that is an upper middle manager for a S&P 500 company. In this client's case, what we did was a combination of things. Number one, they were receiving primarily RSUs. She didn't realize at her level of employment that there was actually the benefit of negotiating what kind of options she was using. So the first thing that we did is worked with her and given her some tips in terms of negotiating the better types of things. So for her, it was a combination of ISOs and NSOs to help lower the tax implications. For the same client too, another strategy that we had looked at, because we were bullish on the stock at the time, was using what's called an 83B election. What this is, and this is available for both ISOs and NSOs, is within 30 days of the grant of the stock option, what the client can do is take the 83B election, and what happens is any gain in that 30 days, so let's say it's $10 at the date of grant, within 30 days they exercise, and let's say it's $12 per share at that point, then that $2 is treated as ordinary income, and then they have to hold the stock for a period of time, but the growth at that point is treated as long-term capital gains. So the advantage there is it switches some growth that would have been ordinary income, converts it to long-term capital gains. The downside is taxes that were going to be delayed are pulled forward to today. So she had some other stock options that were already vested that we had her sell for diversification purposes, and we used some of those proceeds to help cover the taxes.
And, you know, it really surprises me in the case of this client where she was getting RSUs and the company had things like ISOs and NSOs, why they wouldn't have given the employee the more advantageous tax options. Is it just, once again, the company is trying to benefit itself in some way by not having to issue the stock?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think there's really two things at work in these type of examples. Because, you know, this employee, for example, was given some NSOs. There's no ISOs at the time that were being given. Part of that, I think, is her manager and her HR person that she was working with honestly wasn't fully knowledgeable in terms of what would be advantageous. And then also on the employee, they just frankly weren't aware of what was going to benefit them most. And this is why it's really, really important when you have this type of compensation to work with a financial planner and a CPA that can help you not just with the tax planning, but with the negotiation process as well, because that can save you tens of thousands in taxes potentially.
Now, let's talk about AMT, because as you pointed out with ISOs, from the date they're granted to the exercise date, that amount in the example you gave where the stock goes from 10 to 15, that $5 is subject to AMT. Is there any way to minimize that?
There are some strategies. One is the 83B election that can circumvent that. Because remember, with the ISO, to get that treatment, there's holding period requirements. You have to hold for 1 year before you exercise. You have to hold 2 years before you sell from the date of grant. So if we do the 83B election, it breaks that, so you're no longer part of the ISO. So there's things like that that can be done. Other things, again, it goes back to the negotiating with the company and maybe asking for NSOs. Oftentimes, if a client is subject to AMT, it can actually be an interesting opportunity, but normally the goal is to avoid taxes, right? We want to pay only what we need to. We don't want to pay more than that. AMT, unfortunately, creates a higher hurdle that no matter what, you can avoid as much as you want. You still have to hit that threshold. So for AMT planning purposes, a lot of times I like to lean into it and fill up their tax bucket at least to that AMT threshold, because they have to pay that amount anyways without any sort of planning benefit. So we'll do some options planning strategies where we will actually create more taxes up to that AMT amount because they have to pay that anyways. But then long-term, we can convert things that would have been ordinary income, put it into long-term capital gains. So we'll lower their future tax rate.
Well, assuming that they get tax reform this year, which is still a big if, long-term capital gains, depending on whose plan you're looking at, would go down to 15%. The Obamacare taxes would go away. So long-term capital gains at 15 would certainly beat ordinary income taxes at 35%. How do you advise, Paul, clients that have concentrated stock positions as a result of their executive compensation? It's not unusual. I've seen it in my career where a client will come in, he's the top executive, and almost half his net worth is in one company stock. What do you do in situations like that?
At that point, it's very important to look at scenario analysis using some advanced financial planning techniques that we have and kind of looking at a Monte Carlo simulation and what kind of the spread on the projected stock return would be. So that's an important part of the equation. But again, it really just comes down to matching the solutions to the client's needs. So if they're focused on wealth transfer, there's some trust planning that can be done or family foundation. If we're looking for diversification, there's some advanced strategies we can use like an exchange fund or doing some sort of options planning around that. Otherwise, if it's liquidity or hedging purposes, again, there's some advanced stock options planning that can be done or variable prepaid forward contracts as well. So there are options out there to create diversification for the client that has a concentrated stock position.
And I guess finally, what sort of tips would you give to listeners that have executive plans, whether it's, you know, something like an ISO or NSO or RSU or even things like deferred compensation? I know we have had clients who have had deferred compensation where we have delayed taking their Social Security to age 70, so it grows at 32% to age 70, and we have taken out their deferred comp in lower tax years. What kind of advice would you give to somebody that has a compensation plan?
I would say two things. Number one, know your tax situation. And number two, know your financial goal. What is it that you want to accomplish with that benefit that you have? Third thing that's really important is to know your rights as an employee. And what I mean by that is know what your company offers and what is available to you to make sure that you're planning your compensation in a way that's going to be most advantageous.
Well, listen, Paul, if our listeners would like to contact you, let's say there's an executive out there with a compensation plan, how could they do so?
Absolutely. My phone number is 888-486-3939, extension 105. Again, that's 888-486-3939, extension 105. Or I can be reached by email at paul@paplava.com. Again, that's just paul@paplava.com.
Well, listen, Paul, thanks for coming on the program and enlightening our listeners. All the best to you, sir.
Thank you, Jim. It's been my pleasure. Have a great day.
Well, that concludes today's interview. Once again, as you heard there, there were different kind of executive packages. And one of the mistakes that we often see individuals make is, for example, the case study that Paul talked about. We had an executive that was getting RSUs, which were less favorable to her as tax planning because it was all taxed as ordinary income. And her HR personnel really weren't aware of, for example, the tax advantages of a ISO plan. And so we were able to convert in negotiations her stock options to ISOs. So it really pays for tax planning, especially if you are 5-10 years away from retirement. Think about cashing in on those options or deferred comp and paying long-term capital gains taxes, which could be lowered as much as 15% versus today's high income tax rates, which are over 44%, depending on which bracket of compensation that you live in. What is really important here is really get together with your financial advisor and your CPA and do some tax planning. It can make a world of difference for your retirement. In the meantime, well, we've run out of time. We'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.